Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the April-May 2024 issue of Guideposts magazine with articles like A Place of Hope, Spiritual Notebook. If, like me, you live with a chronic illness, you probably spend a lot of time in waiting rooms. Did you ever think they could be a place of hope? By Roberta Messner, Huntington, West Virginia. I hobbled into the doctor's office at the medical center, so weak and tired that I had to use a walker, too out of breath to mutter what I was thinking. I thought I was done with this, God. You'd think that after almost 6 decades of living with neurofibromatosis, a genetic condition that caused painful and persistent tumors to grow on my face and body, that I would be used to this. After all, from the time I was diagnosed when I was 9, I had spent more hours in more doctors' waiting rooms than I could count. But just 4 years earlier, the pain I'd contended with nearly all my life miraculously vanished. It was a healing I knew could come only from God, and I'd allowed myself to believe that my days of being ruled by my pain and illness were over. Only to have myself laid low by a medication side effect that was wreaking havoc on my body. Now here I was again, shuffling into a specialist's waiting room, the gastroenterologist this time, feeling defeated. My body had let me down, and it felt as if God had too. I slumped into a hardback chair. None of the other patients even looked up. I couldn't blame them. They probably just want to get this over and done with as much as I do. But the scene made me think of a long ago morning my mother and I had spent in a room much like this one. Mom used to take me to the neurofibromatosis specialists all over the country. That morning, we were at a huge hospital in the city we had taken a train to. We sat in a row of hard plastic chairs with tired-looking strangers, waiting and waiting. Mom had brought along an overstuffed tote that would have filled Mary Poppins with envy. Mom had given it a name, of all things, in the meantime. Her eyes took in the room, and as she pulled out storybooks and puzzles, as well as jars with glistening contents topped with dollies, I brought along some of my peach preserves for everyone, she announced. I cringed. With our country accents and ways, I was sure we would be the target of ridicule here in the city. Instead, the most astonishing thing happened. Chairs scooted together, stories tumbled out about grandma's kitchens in California and Maine and Michigan, where jellies glistened like precious jewels on windowsills. We weren't strangers anymore. The hard plastic chairs hadn't changed, nor had the hardships in our lives. But we had. Now I looked around the gastroenterologist's waiting room. People were lost in their cell phones. Not a single soul made eye contact. I was on my own here. A nurse informed me that blood work was required, which meant I had to go to the lab. I followed signs through an endless maze of hallways, pushing my walker. Finally, I arrived at another waiting room filled with folks looking down at their phones. By then, I was so wiped out, it didn't quite register that most of them had chemo ports in their arms. I just collapsed into a seat to wait my turn to have blood drawn. All I could do was stare at the floor to the lab. A heaviness filled the room, the kind of heaviness that takes over when people are waiting to face something unwelcome. The door suddenly opened, and a woman burst into the room, brandishing a tote that Mom would have approved of. "It's the chemo crafter," I heard a few patients say. The crafter headed straight for a man across from me. She reached into her tote and with a flourish pulled out a calico tool organizer. "I made this just for you," she said, handing him the gift. "My life's held together with duct tape, ma'am," the man said, tugging on a beard flecked with gray. "I haven't done any work since the cancer hit, but this makes me want to visit my garage and see what I might be able to fix up. Thank you kindly." The crafter turned and took a long look at me, noting the silver and turquoise earrings that dangled to my shoulders. It had taken me 30 minutes to pull on a pair of socks, but I'd worn these earrings for some sense of normalcy. "Say, you like jewelry," the crafter hollered. "How about traveling light?" The patient beside me explained, "She makes earrings from Dr. Pepper soda can tabs." How could I not be intrigued? I tried on a pair. By then, everyone else had put down their phones to watch the goings-on. Wow, those earrings were light. Suddenly, I felt lighter, too. "Roberta Messner," a nurse beckoned from the doorway. We've been looking all over for you. I'd confused the oncology clinic with the lab. I stood to leave and the smiles of my comrades in waiting went with me. I may have been in the wrong waiting room, but God had put me right where I needed to be. The day took me two or more waiting rooms. Even though the doctors couldn't do much more than assure me the side effect would subside over time, I found my mind humming with possibility. Mom and the crafter hadn't let the surroundings keep them from being a blessing. Could I do the same? On the way home, I stopped at a consignment store for a little diversion. Just inside the door was a magazine rack labeled Free to a Good Home. There was a brand new Country Living, a Victoria, even a guidepost. A plan formed in my mind. I pack a tote with new magazines before my next doctor's appointments. Then in the waiting room, I'd strike up a conversation with the person next to me to get a sense of what they might like. 2 weeks later, I put my plan into action. "What do you like to do?" I asked the woman who sat down beside me in the waiting room, her cane clattering, her shoulders sagging. "I used to love to host tea parties," she said. "Would you like this?" I asked, pulling the new Victoria from my tote. There was a blue and white China tea set on the cover. "How lovely," she said. "Are you sure I can keep this?" She sat up straighter, a soft smile crossing her face as she leafed through the magazine. It wasn't a handmade gift like the crafter offered, but it was heartfelt, and it took me out of myself. Weeks later, I ran into the same lady at Home Goods in, you guessed it, the tea aisle. She was still on her cane, but planning a get-together with her daughters. "I'm going to try that crumb cake recipe in the magazine you gave me," she said, "and serve it with raspberry tea. I took a box home, too." For my next doctor visit, I tucked packets of herbal tea in my tote. As I was sharing them along with my magazines, a nurse called for Roberta. I stood to follow her, and so did a couple others. Two of us were sent back to wait. "I haven't known three Robertas my whole life," a lady remarked. Soon the whole place was a chatter with nicknames people had come up with for Roberta. "What did they call you?" a fellow asked me. Back when I was a nurse, a restaurant delivery guy misspelled my name on a little brown bag. Robesta. The staff and patients got a kick out of it and took to calling me that. It stuck till the day I retired. An elderly man on oxygen who hadn't uttered a word spoke between gulps of air. "You're the Robesta I've ever known." Everyone chuckled at the dearness, the effort it had taken for the gentleman to give us a little joy when life had put us all on hold, and we thought all we could do was wait. Not unlike those strangers in the long ago waiting room with my mother. In life's uncertain meantime, Mom had chanced vulnerability in order to offer the most important gift she could, herself. She just hadn't dispensed puzzles and peach preserves that day. She created a place that brought people together, a place of hope. It brought to mind a verse from Isaiah, "They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength." God had been with us there, as he is in every waiting place. No chair or situation is ever too hard for him. Neighbor to neighbor, the apple pie solution. They say good fences make good neighbors. What happens when neighbors can't agree on a fence? By Jeannie Hughes, Hurricane, West Virginia. Our next door neighbor stood on our front porch. "We want to attach a chain link fence to your white vinyl one," the wife said. "That's not going to work," my husband Roger said, shaking his head. "Our fence is inside the property line. We need to mow and trim between the two fences." "That's ridiculous," the husband said, his voice rising. "We have every right to put our fence on the edge of our property." Before we could respond, the couple stormed off. "So much for the times you sat out here with him talking politics," I said to Roger. "And to think we helped her with yard work all last year when he was out of town," Roger said. From that point on, our neighbors refused to acknowledge our waves hello. I tried to forget about the argument, but then they had the gall to start letting their dog use our unfenced front yard to do his business. I couldn't help but think of what Robert Frost once wrote, "Good fences make good neighbors." A few weeks later, I was out shopping for a replacement for my broken butter dish when I noticed a display of pie plates. The ivory one on top of the stack had "Love Thy Neighbor" spelled out in blue. "Okay, God," I said. "I get the message." I bought the plate and loaded up on Granny Smith apples. That afternoon, as I rolled out the dough for the pie, I prayed that it wouldn't tear and that the top and bottom crust wouldn't separate. I wanted my piece pie to be perfect. I hope they'll accept my gesture, I told Roger. Maybe I'm putting too much faith in my baking. Once the pie had cooled, I headed next door. I almost chickened out and turned back, but then forced myself to ring the doorbell. I could hear the terrier start barking like crazy. Please let it be the wife and not the husband who comes out, I whispered. The door opened. It was the wife. Hi, I baked this apple pie for you, I said. She reached out and silently took the pie from my hands. Please keep the plate, I sputtered. She just looked at me for a moment, then slowly closed the door. I walked back to our house. Oddly enough, I didn't feel rejected at all. Quite the opposite, in fact. I envisioned the wife slicing into the pie and discovering "Love thy neighbor" written across the bottom of the dish. Hopefully that message would get through. A few days later, I was out in the front yard when the wife passed me in her truck. My hand shot up in greeting. She returned my wave. I ran into our house and found Roger. She waved back at me. "And you were worried your apple pie wasn't good," he said. Still, we weren't surprised when the husband put up a chain-link fence right at the property line. Although we can't trim between the fences, we didn't say anything to the neighbors. It just didn't seem worth damaging our relationship further. Maybe even bad fences can make good neighbors. Meanwhile, the wife keeps waving and even says hello. Her husband still shuns us. But that's okay. I'll keep following those heavenly nudges, even though restoring our neighborly relationship might seem like pie in the sky. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Building Stronger Families, Micah's Big Move. Did my daughter really think organizing her new apartment was more important than Mother's Day? By Stephanie Thompson, Edmond, Oklahoma. I stood in the doorway of my daughter Micah's bedroom, not wanting to step into what resembled a toxic waste dump. Black garbage bags bulging with stuff she insisted wasn't trash. A tower of overflowing storage bins. Mountains of clothes all over the place that Micah was randomly sorting through. How at 20 years old was Micah completely incapable of keeping her room clean and tidy? The craziest part was she didn't even live here anymore. She just dropped by our house occasionally to do laundry. Her first 2 years of college, she'd lived in the dorm in a sorority house, where presumably there was some accountability. In less than 2 weeks, she'd be moving into an off-campus townhouse with her sorority sister, Asia. God, is Micah really ready to live on her own? It was a question I'd been asking God a lot lately. I wanted her to stay in supervised housing, but my husband Michael had supported her desire for independence. And finally, I just shrugged and got along with them. Micah looked up from her pile. Finals are over next Friday. Then on Saturday and Sunday, I'm moving. So I won't have time to do anything with you on Mother's Day, she said. Can we celebrate later? It would be better for me in a couple weeks. I frowned. Micah had mentioned something about this a month ago. I'd let it drop, hoping she would come to her senses. After all, part of maturity was about knowing your priorities. I can't move Mother's Day, I said. Dad and I are helping you move on Saturday. Grammy, Mama, and I would love to celebrate with you on Sunday. It will only be an hour or two. I wasn't planning anything formal, just dinner at our house with my mom and my husband's grandmother. Micah was going to cook steaks. I'd make dessert. We'd open gifts. I won't have time, Micah said, throwing her hands in the air. I'm moving into my first house this once. You have Mother's Day every year. Can we do it another day? Wow, did my daughter really think her moving was more important than honoring me and the women who'd helped raise her? I turned and walked down the hall, shaking my head. Parenting had been so much easier when Michael was younger, and I made most of the decisions for her. Life was way more complicated than when I was her age. Maybe I was a helicopter parent, but I didn't regret it for 1 minute. Things changed, though, when Micah was in high school and could drive. She made friends and did things that Michael and I didn't always agree with. Mistakes are part of growing up, Michael reminded me. At least while our daughter lived under our roof, we could talk to her about choices and consequences. When she was in college, I couldn't monitor her grades and her decisions. I worried whether she was taking academics seriously and what effect that would have on her future. Now, here she was, brushing off Mother's Day, acting more like a self-centered tween than a responsible young adult. I stewed over it the rest of the day, long after Micah went back to campus. What if she wasn't mature enough to handle having her own place? If she failed at living independently, wouldn't that mean I had failed too as her mother? That I hadn't prepared her well for life? Michael must have sensed how upset I was. "I have an idea," he said that night. "I'm off Friday. Let me take you to a Mother's Day brunch in Oklahoma City at the Latin place everyone's talking about. Just the two of us." I agreed, though it felt a bit like a consolation prize. Still, Michael and I rarely went out to eat, and a fancy brunch would be a real treat. That Friday, Michael and I shared a table for two at Cafe Caco. After we ordered, I confided how disappointed I was about Micah's choice to blow off Mother's Day. Michael nodded and took my hand. What I didn't confide was my worry that I hadn't done a good job as a mother. I sipped a smooth latte and dug into my French toast with fresh fruit and warm caramel syrup. It was just the indulgence I needed. As we were leaving, my phone rang. Micah's face filled the screen. "I just finished my last final," she said. "I did really well this semester. I made my best grade since freshman year in high school." Before I could congratulate her, she said, "Oh my gosh, Mom, the people who moved out of our new place left a totally disgusting mess. There's no way we can move in until it's cleaned. Would you come over and help me?" I almost laughed. Micah ditches me for Mother's Day, and now she's asking me to help her clean. But I didn't have to think twice about my answer. My daughter needed me. Of course I would be there. Naturally, Micah hadn't thought of cleaning supplies when she was gathering up all her things to bring to her new home. I met her at the townhouse at 5 p.m., toting a vacuum, broom, mop, and bucket, plus an armful of household cleaning products and rolls of paper towels. "Would you mop the floor?" she asked. "There's some kind of sticky glitter everywhere. I'll take care of the bathrooms." I'd only been mopping for a few minutes when Micah came to check on me. "It looks like you mopped here, Mom, but there's still some glitter left. How do you think we can get rid of it?" She squatted and ran her nails over what looked like clumps of glitter glue. I stifled a giggle. "Save your manicure," I said as I got down on my knees with a scrub brush. "I've got this." For the next 3 hours, my formerly messy daughter directed me on what to clean and how to clean it. Micah rarely lifted a finger around our house, but now I saw her scouring counters, sinks, and toilets like a merry maid. She wiped down walls, doors, and their handles, and even washed windows and sills. Who knew? As we worked, she told me all the ideas she had and Asia had about how they would arrange furniture, get other household supplies they lack, split bills, fix up the courtyard. She was so excited, I couldn't help but feel a twinge of pride and excitement, too. But something bothered me. "Hey, where is Asia?" I asked Micah. "Shouldn't she be helping you clean?" "Asia works full-time and doesn't get off until late. Then she's got to work tomorrow while I move in. On Sunday, I'm helping her get her stuff out of the sorority house in storage." Micah paused. I looked up from my scrubbing. "Asia's parents don't support her in the same way that you and Dad support me," she said. "I want to have everything ready so she can get all her stuff moved in on Sunday since she has to work Monday." All of a sudden, I saw my daughter in a whole new light. She had come up with a realistic schedule. She prioritized helping a friend who needed the help. Micah wasn't just clean and organized. She was compassionate, responsible, unselfish, mature. I hadn't failed her as a mother at all, but I had failed to recognize the great young adult she was turning into. It was time for me to stop hovering. Micah was ready for me to step back and let her become the person God had planned for her to be. We finished cleaning the townhouse a little after 8 p.m. Micah gave me a hug goodbye. "Thanks, Mom," she said. "I could never have done this without you." Late Saturday evening, after Michael and I helped Micah move into her new home, she dropped by our house and surprised me with a hanging basket of Gerber daisies. I hugged her tight. It was a beautiful Mother's Day gift, but even more beautiful was seeing how my daughter had blossomed, the best gift any mother could hope for. Joy at work. How could I supervise someone who resented me for getting the job she wanted? Reflect Joy, by Elizabeth Gray, Fairfax Station, Virginia. When my department at work announced that they were hiring for my supervisor's recently vacated position, I knew I wanted to apply for it. I also knew there would be a big problem. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I worked for an agency seeking to reduce family violence, suicide, and other harmful behaviors in military families. It's a challenging job, but a rewarding one. I coordinated a nationwide network of victim advocates. Others in the office worked on programs dealing with child abuse, domestic violence, spousal neglect, and other issues. The job opening was to supervise the entire department. I'd been a military social worker for nearly 2 decades. I had the skills and experience to move into leadership, and I felt ready to seek a promotion. There was one problem: my colleague Brenda. Brenda had been in the department a long time. She was hard to get along with. She complained about everything and flat out refused to do certain tasks. She criticized people, picked fights, and dragged her feet on difficult assignments. Longevity and departmental politics kept her from getting fired. Brenda had been turned down for promotions in the past, but that wouldn't stop her from applying this time. She would not be happy to learn she had competition, especially not from me. Thinking about the inevitable encounter with her made me doubt myself. There were a lot of talented people in our office. Why was I worthy of becoming the supervisor? Who did I know to be the best leader? I prayed about it and felt I should at least try. My husband Cody encouraged me too. I applied for the job. The rumor mill ensured that everyone knew who'd apply and who was selected for an interview. I was one of 4 interviewed candidates. So was Brenda. How would you address conflict within your team? The interview panel asked right off the bat. Was I imagining things, or did I sense they were referring to conflict with Brenda? With compassion, patience, and transparency, I said, I find that most workplace conflict can be mitigated with a growth mindset. I told them about an office dispute I diffused a few years back. Soon I learned that Brenda and I were both finalists for the position. That's when she pounced. What makes you so special? She snarled one day, confronting me in the hall. I've been here longer than you. You should wait your turn. She tried to turn people in the office against me. Why would you try to steal that job from her? Someone asked me. They interviewed you because you're younger, someone else said. Brenda told me you sucked up to the bosses, said another. Brenda's tactics failed to get her the job, but she succeeded in rattling me to the core. When the announcement came that I'd be the new supervisor, I had no desire to celebrate. Instead, I was filled with dread at having to lead an office that now resented me. And I dreaded managing Brenda. I decided the only way to get off to a good start was to talk to my team members one-on-one using all the social work skills I'd learned. My office was the same cubicle I'd had before, so I held these conversations in a small conference room. Most went much better than I expected. People seemed willing to give me the benefit of the doubt. They appreciated that I took the time to meet with them, and together we set mutual goals. Then came the conversation with Brenda. Why should I accept you as my supervisor when all I feel is betrayal? She demanded before she'd even sat down. It went downhill from there. Brenda blamed me for her failure to get the job, reiterated that I betrayed her, expressed her disdain for me and the people who'd hired me. No amount of empathetic listening, reframing, or seeking common ground worked. We stalked out of the room as mad as she'd been when she entered it. I walked back to my cubicle in shock. How was I supposed to manage someone like that? I felt simultaneously angry and deeply insecure. Maybe Brenda was right after all. Maybe I was in over my head. I needed a quiet place to think. The conference room was occupied, and all I had was my cubicle. I lowered my head and pretended to look through files. God, you brought this opportunity to me, but this isn't looking good, I whispered. How can I lead someone who thinks so little of me? I took a deep breath to keep from crying. Then a voice sounded in my head. Reflect joy. What was that supposed to be, a message from God? Who was feeling any joy right now? The words sounded again. They were insistent enough that I sat up and wrote them on a piece of paper. I had no idea what they meant or how to put them into action. God seemed to think they were important. I wrote them again for emphasis. And then it hit me. The words' meaning was so obvious, I laughed out loud. I looked around to see if anyone heard me. I did not have to absorb all the negativity Brenda hurled at me. Like the social worker I was, I could let her express her feelings, then reflect back something different. I could show her and everyone else in the office that I consider it an honor to be entrusted with their work and their intense feelings it generates. I could project what I really felt, that I love my job and I am proud to serve with colleagues dedicated to making life better for military families. I could even give thanks for the chance to lead Brenda. It would be a challenge, but also a learning opportunity. With God's help, I could figure things out. Starting that day, I changed my whole approach. When harsh words were directed at me, I resisted the temptation to feel angry or wounded. I validated difficult feelings and projected joy, kindness, and gratitude. For Brenda, I took the extra step of writing the words, "Reflect Joy," on every file that related to her work. In my calendar, I called one-on-one meetings with her, "Joyful Reflections." I grouped her emails under the heading RJ. I also reminded myself that Brenda had her own challenges in life. She had relocated multiple times for her spouse's career and kept having to earn new academic degrees to keep up with the job requirements. She was the primary caretaker for several members of her extended family and carried a lot of stress and responsibility. That didn't give her the right to be hurtful, but it helped me keep our relationship in perspective. "Thanks for trusting me with your feelings," I'd say each time she complained. "How can I support you?" My approach caught Brenda off guard. For a long time, she tried to derail me. Eventually, she seemed to give up and accept that I wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't a love fest, but it kept the peace. For me, the rewards were God-sized. The more joy I reflected, the calmer and more assured I became. I developed an ability to flip into joy mode whenever people got upset or took out their frustrations on me. I was an island of no-nonsense positivity in a stressful workplace where every case we deal with was literally a matter of life and death. Several years later, Brenda moved to another agency. On her last day in our department, she came to my cubicle. I braced myself for one final blast. "Thank you for not giving up on me," she said matter-of-factly, "and for always finding joy." We shook hands and she walked away. I haven't seen Brenda since then. I'm grateful to her for helping me learn one of the most valuable workplace lessons. No matter how hard a job is, joy can guide you through. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.